In the pristine community of Matacock, Harriet Osborne's once showcase home has transformed into a wild, untamed landscape that horrifies neighbors. What they don't realize is that this isn't neglect, it's rebirth. Like her overgrown property, Harriet herself is undergoing a metamorphosis from discarded advertising executive to something far more powerful. This transformation mirrors a truth many women discover in midlife. Invisibility can become your greatest strength. What happens when women who've been systematically pushed aside suddenly discover extraordinary abilities? The Change explores this question through three women entering perimenopause who find themselves wielding supernatural powers. Their story has resonated deeply with women over 40, sparking viral discussions about embracing midlife transformation rather than fearing it. The novel's brilliance lies in its reimagining of menopause not as decline, but as awakening. Those hot flashes, mood swings, and physical changes aren't failures of the female body. They're transformations into something new and potentially more powerful. When society stops seeing you, perhaps that's precisely when you become most dangerous. Nessa James, a widowed nurse with twin daughters, can communicate with murder victims. This inherited gift disappeared during her childbearing years, but returned in her 50s when she began hearing murdered girls calling from Danscommer Beach. Harriet Osborne, once a successful advertising executive, discovered her connection to plant life after her husband's betrayal. Her garden became an extension of herself, wild and potentially deadly, as she harnessed medicinal and poisonous plants. Jo Leveson lost her hotel executive position after confronting a guest who sexually assaulted an employee. During that confrontation, she discovered supernatural strength and heat generation. Now running a women's gym called Furious Fitness, Jo can melt metal and ignite fires with her touch. These women are bound by their abilities and society's dismissal. Each has experienced the invisibility common to aging women. Their powers emerge as manifestations of rage, wisdom, and strength accumulated through decades of navigating a world designed to diminish them. The plot begins when a decomposing female body is discovered in a garbage bag on Danscommer Beach. Nessa, who can see the dead, leads Jo and Harriet to the body. The victim, the girl in blue, is just the first. Nessa's visions reveal two more female spirits underwater, suggesting additional victims. These murders connect to a pattern of disappearances that authorities have dismissed. When Mandy Welsh vanished, police told her mother that girls like her run away all the time, despite contrary evidence. The victims share a common profile: young women from disadvantaged backgrounds whose disappearances generate minimal official concern. The novel exposes how society's indifference towards certain victims, particularly poor, young women of color, allows predators to operate unchecked. The runaway classification reflects real-world patterns where missing persons receive vastly different attention based on race, class, and perceived social value. When Jo and Nessa report to Police Chief John Rocca, they face institutional resistance, forcing them to seek justice through podcast host Josh Gibbon, whose They Walk Among Us reaches 30 million listeners. When an intruder attempts to kidnap Joe's daughter Lucy, Jo overpowers him, leaving a burn mark on his face. The attack confirms their fear. Official channels have failed to protect them. Lucy suffers nightmares while Jo installs additional security and sleeps with a baseball bat nearby. The women confront a crucial question: what happens when protective systems become corrupt? Detective Reese argues, justice may be slow, but she's also relentless. Jo counters, while we wait for evidence, another girl could be murdered. This tension intensifies as police corruption emerges. The novel explores vigilante justice's moral complexity. When Harriet suggests killing their primary suspect, neither Jo nor Nessa immediately objects, reflecting their disillusionment with failed systems. Each woman carries personal experiences of institutional failure. Joe's dismissed domestic violence complaints, Ness's ignored workplace harassment, Harriet's sister's buried case. Haven't we all experienced moments when official channels failed us? The novel asks, is vengeance sometimes necessary when justice is fundamentally broken? The investigation leads to Culling Point, an exclusive billionaire community whose name reflects its dark history. In the 1600s, colonists massacred natives on this land, then killed deer they believed possessed by Satan. Claude Marchand, initially appearing as an ally, actually works with Leonard Shaw, the king of Culling Point. Under the guise of offering opportunities, they've been recruiting vulnerable young women for wealthy men. When Spencer Harding joined their circle, girls began disappearing and dying. This conspiracy forms the novel's sharpest critique of wealth and power. The ultra-rich have created a parallel universe where depravity thrives unchecked. Even Chief Rocca is implicated, not merely negligent, but an active predator who assaulted Amber Welsh years earlier. Claude's justification that she extracted millions for charity and protected most girls reveals how abuse systems perpetuate through moral compromise. Her journey from financial ruin victim to abuse facilitator demonstrates how exploitation can transform victims into perpetrators when sufficiently rewarded. Joe ignites the yellow Scotch broom bushes Harriet had strategically planted throughout Culling Point. These invasive plants, chosen for their explosive properties, create an unstoppable inferno, consuming the mansions of wealthy predators who thought themselves untouchable. From a fishing boat, Harriet watches justice manifest in towering flames. This fiery reckoning represents more than revenge. It's a ritual of purification, echoing ancient cleansing ceremonies. The land, carrying centuries of violence from colonial massacres to modern predation, is finally cleansed. The novel suggests some corruptions run so deep within institutions that they cannot be reformed but must be burned away completely, like forests requiring periodic burning for health. 5 years later, Culling Point stands as a charred testament, now a whale conservation area. The third murdered girl is identified as 15-year-old May Jones. Lucy, now 12, channels her trauma into strength through self-defense classes funded by Leonard Shaw's seized estate, teaching other girls to protect themselves. The resolution avoids simple moral conclusions. Their vigilante justice succeeded where official channels failed, but at enormous cost, existing in a morally ambiguous space that challenges readers to consider what justice means in a fundamentally unjust world. The change challenges society's view of aging women, historically feared as witches or rendered invisible. The novel reclaims this narrative, suggesting patriarchy fears women's power, not their decline. Isabel describes women's lives in three stages: education, creation, and protection. The third stage, beyond reproductive years, holds immense potential. Women must destroy the world men built, she declares, to build a better world from its ashes. The novel confronts how violence against women is portrayed. When podcast host Josh approaches Joe, she criticizes him for naming killers while forgetting victims. His detailed knowledge of perpetrators while forgetting victims reveals how women become nameless props in sensationalized narratives. Unlike conventional crime stories, The Change centers victims' experiences rather than the killer's psychology. Spencer Harding remains purposefully underdeveloped, denying him the prominence typically given to villains. The novel ultimately asks what world might emerge if we valued women's anger, experience, and power as much as their youth and beauty, burning away what no longer serves while cultivating something new.